part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time.
It's always funny that Jack had asked me last week if I had actually ever done your podcast. And for some reason, at the time he asked me, I had forgotten.
Oh, it's been a long time.
4 years ago. 4 years ago, we did the Flesh and Blood one.
Yeah, I can't believe that it's been 4 years. And I can't believe I've been doing this podcast for that long. No, we did Flesh and Blood for Ain't It Cool. And then, Ain't It Cool didn't do at the time like recorded interviews, and so that was transcribed, and I just took the audio and put it on my website. So
Well, that's what I did, is I went to your website, and then I was reminded. Then I actually that afternoon I actually sat and listened to the whole thing again.
I started listening to the beginning. Well, let's get started with this episode, shall we?
Sure, I guess.
Cool.
Sure.
All right. Well, this is Part-Time Fanboy, and I am Christian Horn, and I have two veteran comic creators on the line with me who, again, have been on the podcast before. I have Jack Herman, who is a comic book writer and, to me, most importantly, the co-creator of Villains of Vigilantes. we had you on like several months ago talking about, you know, the fundraising for that. And then we also have Neil Vokes, who is an esteemed, to me, comics illustrator, because I know your work from, I think I was introduced to it through the Superman Adventures book back in the day, and which to me, even to this day, is they're some of the best Superman stories ever done, in my opinion. If people are looking for alternatives to, you know, what's currently happening in the DC universe, which I'm not necessarily a big fan of, not to trash anyone, but those Superman Adventures books that you and I think Mark Millar kind of work did some of the writing
actually,
on those.
Several different writers, actually.
Yeah.
A bunch of guys, about a half dozen different writers.
Yeah, yeah. And then you also did the Flesh and Blood books with Monsterverse, which were also fantastic, in my opinion. So.
Though we never finished it, at least so far.
Well, you know, there's still time, you know.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too, because those are really great books. So for this episode is a big love fest for me, because you've got creators that I both, whose work I really enjoy. And I thank you guys for coming on, even though Neil has a touch of the flu. So, you know, he's slowly dying on the other end, but I wanted to come on. So we're on this episode to talk about, you guys have a Kickstarter going on for something that you worked on. You're revitalizing, you're bringing back a title that you worked on almost 30 years, right?
It was exactly, actually, this year's the 30th anniversary of when the book first came out.
Yeah. Wow. And the book is called Eagle, correct?
Yep.
Yeah, and it's something, I mean, the video that you guys, first of all, let's tell people that there's a Kickstarter, and where can they can just go to Kickstarter and search for Eagle or search for Neil Vokes? How do they find the Kickstarter?
So far, I've been sharing the link. I don't know how you would specifically get there to go to the website, except to go to the website, maybe put in the search engine or something in there and write out the name of the book or something like that.
Okay. Well, I'll say that I was able to re-find it by typing in your name, Neil Vokes, and it came up immediately. So go to Kickstarter.com, type in Neil Vokes, and support this project, because you've got two really great creators. So
and there's still another 12 days, I believe, left to the thing. So
yeah, absolutely. And you guys have reached your goal. Congratulations on that. But there's always, you know, stretch goals and, you know, more money is good. So help these guys out, you know, by contributing as much as you can. That being said, so this is something you guys worked on 30 years ago. What got you guys interested in bringing it back? Like, especially in today's comic market?
Well, I think in my case, I've been wanting to bring it back ever since we stopped doing it. Because it was just, it was like, as they say, it was one of my children, you know, it was one of my babies before I had a real baby. And I really loved doing it. It was primarily the second major thing I did in comics, because the first thing never got published, but the second major thing was, of course, the Robotech book by Kimiko. And that couple of years that we worked on that, Rich Rankin and I, we started to come up with some of our own ideas. And then around that time, in fact, some of this story I told it on the Flesh and Blood podcast, how back then we decided to do our own project because the black and white thing just started up with the Mutant Turtles.
Yeah.
And a few other things popped up. And we said, you know, why don't we try something? We'll see what happens. And we actually created our own book, and it actually did really, really well. We left the Robotech books and did Eagle, I think, more or less for about 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Jack came in almost literally at the last second, because Rich and I had worked up the original project and actually had drawn, I'm pretty sure we had drawn the entire book. I know Jack might have to remind me of this, but we talked to Jack because we had met Jack through the Kimiko guys, of course. We got to know Jack because of he was working, I believe, on Elementals at the time, Jack?
Yeah, that's right. I was working on the Elementals. It was a Bill Willingham superhero project, which was kind of a spinoff from his Death Duel of the Destroyers and Island of Dr. Apocalypse Adventures from V&V. And when I got into Kimiko that way, I wound up scripting two of the Robotech books. There were three books. Neil penciled one of them, the Robotech Masters, and I was scripting the other two, the Macross Saga and the New Generation.
Yeah.
And so we missed, I always felt that we missed working together back in the day then, because just through luck of the draw, we wound up on different books. But
we talked to Jack about this Eagle thing, and though I didn't know it at the time, how excellent he was as a off the cuff kind of writer, because I'm kind of that way as an artist, as Jack discovered through the years. And we came to Jack, said, we need somebody to dialogue this, because Rich and I we just don't know dialogue. We plotted it, we drew it, but we just don't know dialogue very well. Would you be willing to do this? And we literally, again, if I remember correctly, we literally asked him to do this over a weekend.
Oh, wow.
And this was this was a project he had never seen before, other than maybe some of the artwork. He didn't know what our you know, we didn't have like a Bible written out of what everything was about. We just kind of explained it to him.
Yeah.
And we said, we need a dialogue. Do you think you could do that like in the next few days? Because we were already selling the idea through the Rich was always already talking to retailers and stuff. And Jack said, sure, why not? And
oh, wow.
I'm not necessarily quoting him exactly. He might have said, oh, God damn it, no. But he did. He went for it. And I swear to God, he did it within a couple of days. And if you read it now, you can't tell that man didn't already know anything about the book.
Oh, that's great.
Really, it was amazing what he pulled off in those few days. And then he literally became a part of the whole creation of Eagle, because a lot of the stuff, as each issue went by, that came out of that, other than what I was putting into it all the time, was, of course, from Jack.
Yeah.
We would work back and forth.
Yeah.
The ideal writer-artist thing I ever had, the thing that actually made me want to work the same way with writers in the future, was the way Jack and I worked together, which was, it was a lot of give and take.
Uh-huh.
He didn't write it and I drew it. I didn't draw it and he wrote it. It was, we worked together on and off. You know, he picked up on the things I was doing. We also were into a lot of the same things, the same kind of movies and comics and stuff. So that helped a lot.
So you guys definitely clicked.
Oh yeah. It was immediate. I was in shock that we were lucky to stumble onto the right writer.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So when you say like scripting, did you have like pages all drawn out and you know,
yeah,
it's basically like,
I believe he had the whole book, didn't you, Jack?
There are a number of pages that were drawn so I could really kind of get a sense of what the characters look like, what the world looked like. But as the book went on, it kind of was just down to like break. I think a lot of it was like, breakdowns for some of it,
well,
or
after
as I recall.
I think the first issue you had probably full pencils at least.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
After that, of course, as we saw how things were going, I would just send you like layouts and notes and things like that.
Oh, that's
and
interesting.
We talked a little bit about what the issue was about, and then when I would dialogue it, I would come up with things to kind of have characters say or, you know, imply things that were going on in the world. And Neil would look at that and say, oh, yeah, that's kind of neat. And that would influence what he would put into the story next issue. And then I would look at what he drew, and that would give me more ideas of things to kind of put into it. So it was a great improvisation kind of back and forth. Between working with Bill Willingham on the Elementals and then working with Neil on Eagle, I really got spoiled in terms of the quality relationship to have with artists working on a comic book series. I guess Robotech too, which much harder work for Neil's because he had to draw all the pages. For me working in Robotech, it was basically being paid to watch cartoons for a living, which is just about the perfect job for me.
That's great. I want that job.
Yeah. So between that and working on Elementals with Willingham, and then of course Eagle with Neil, those were great times.
So this is all through Kimiko?
Yes.
Okay. And so where was, so I'm assuming that you guys lived near each other or that's
no.
how you, no?
no.
How did you
live near each other?
Oh, wow. Really? Well, so wait, where was Kimiko? Cause this is part of sort of comic book.
Kimiko was in Norristown, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And so I was about an hour drive away from them. So I would visit them at their office through the years. At the beginning, Rich and I would go there and hang out with them. We got to know them really well. And that's part of why we also got offered the Robotech thing later. Jack, were you living in Texas at the time?
Actually, no, I was living in Illinois, down in Chicago. So I kind of fell in with through Bill Willingham and Elementals. I kind of wound up at the Kimiko crew. The Elementals project, of course, started out at Texas Comics, where they did their Justice Machine Annual number one. And then when Texas Comics sort of exploded on the launch pad after a pretty promising looking initial craft being built, Bill took the Elementals to Kimiko. I got in there because he put out a call to have some people do potential backup features. And one of those things, everyone said they were going to do something, and just a handful of people stepped up and said, hey, what about this? And I wrote a script for him that he liked enough that he kind of brought me on to script the series, because that was kind of that was going to keep him on his deadline. And that kind of got me in the door. So when the Robotech stuff showed at Kimiko, they were thinking of me, and I got two of those three books. The other one went to Mike Barron, which I feel very lucky I got him when I did, because I suspect Mike would have probably gotten one if not all of them had he gotten to that gig first. So I wound up being writing most of Kimiko's line for a brief moment in history there.
Oh, wow.
and then through our involvement on Robotech, Neil and I, of course, heard of each other.
Well, Rich and I, when we went to Kimiko to tell him about Eagle, we offered Eagle to them, to Kimiko.
Okay.
They didn't want to do it. At the time, Diana Schutz was more or less in charge of the company, even though she wasn't, she didn't run the company. But she was given a lot of power, and she was running it at the time. And I don't know if she didn't get it. She didn't like it. I don't know what it was, because I never got all the details of who. But Phil Lasorda, who was the guy who actually runs the company,
mm-hmm.
Said we weren't going to be doing it. He says, it looks very interesting, but I don't think we're going to do it. Because they were concentrating a lot on licensed stuff at that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't think they were doing a whole lot of original projects at that point. So, which was okay. I mean, I wasn't upset that they didn't want to do it, because, like I said, Rich and I considered doing it. Publishing it ourselves.
Yeah.
Because it seemed that process seemed to work very well for some others. So ultimately, I think it was great that we didn't do it at Kimiko, because I think we were probably allowed to do a lot more of what we wanted to do, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys, so do you self-published it at the time, and it was called like Crystal, I can't remember.
Yeah.
What was it, Crystal Comics?
Yeah, we called it Crystal Comics because of the whole idea of the orb that Eagle has.
Okay. Okay.
And that was our whole thinking of naming it Crystal Comics.
Gotcha. Well, before we move on, and here's the thing is, I'll be honest, is like, I've never read Eagle. It's one of those things that slipped past me,
Okay, but I think this podcast is over.
Well, because I was young. It is harder to find like a lot of that older stuff. Like, I know as far as like Elementals, I scoured like eBay for like a couple of those early issues, and they were not like in great condition, you know. So,
you know, if you had asked it, I would have sent you some.
Oh, well, I didn't even think of it because, you know, yeah, I guess I just didn't. But my point is like for people who don't know what Eagle is, obviously I contributed to the Kickstarter anyway, because you're both creators that I really enjoy and love your stuff. And I'm like, well, if this is like a passion, well, yeah, no problem. But if this is like a passion project for them, then I want to help see it, you know. And looking at Neil's pages, you know, on the Kickstarter, I was like, oh yeah, this is going to be, you know, good stuff. So for people who don't know what Eagle is, what are the general like details?
Well, we came at it originally. It was actually Rich Rankin's was the person who first brought up the concept of Richard Eagle. He of course called him Richard because he was named Rich. And I guess if I came up with it, it would have been Neil Eagle, which doesn't sound very good. But he wanted to do a Richard Eagle psychic detective.
Okay.
He had this idea of him, you know, using psychic powers to solve crimes and things. And I thought, well, that's interesting, but it wasn't interesting enough to this for me, because it wasn't the sort of stuff I was really into, because I was more into, you know, supernatural films and comics and the horror stuff and samurai films, which I was getting really big into in the mid 80s.
Uh-huh.
So the whole martial arts thing had appealed to me. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to throw some of that in there, kind of mix it up a little bit. And then fortuitously, Highlander came out in 1986.
Gotcha.
And that was it. Then right then and there, I knew I had to steal from Highlander and mix that in also with Psychic Detective. And ultimately, he became this this loner, half breed, he's half Japanese, half Caucasian, martial artist who used to be an assassin, and now in this kind of futuristic world, he only uses a sword, never uses a gun, uses martial arts and a sword, and I thought it'd be kind of an interesting dichotomy of all these elements thrown together in one, because the thing I loved about wanted to do in a book like this was to do anything.
Yeah.
To take a project where you can go in any direction whatsoever and it doesn't feel out of place.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought that we could do that with this kind of project, where we could do a sci-fi story and a monster story and a comedy and a Western story or sci-fi, whatever.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought all of those elements together, at least in theory, I thought it would be fun. And that's kind of how we did the series. We kind of did it because it's what interested us. We were having fun doing it. We didn't really... You know, he told maybe years later, didn't look back and go, you know, that was probably the wrong thing to do. We were just enjoying it as we went along.
Uh-huh.
And I've always believed in the theory that if you're enjoying what you're doing, people will enjoy what you're doing.
Sure, sure, sure. Absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, you guys got me sold like right there. I mean, that's a great pitch. Like, you know, samurai, psychic investigator. Like, that's absolutely fantastic. I mean, the original series, you guys, I mean... It's always interesting to me because the market, I mean, was very different back then, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and so it lasted 16 issues, correct? Which is a pretty good run for like an indie book at the time, I would imagine, right?
Well, it actually went more than that. It went to 23 issues, but that was with a different company. That was the problem.
Oh, gotcha.
We did 16 issues for Crystal, but then the black and white boom started to fizzle out. And a lot of retailers were backing off on all these. The main reason all of those books did so well in the first year or so was because they ordered everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you see some of the product that came out, the black and white books, you go, why did they even think that would sell? Because some of it was very amateurish. But it didn't matter because it was one of those cases. It was a feeding frenzy. Oh, this stuff sells great. Let's buy everything.
Yeah.
And so we were caught up in that. Fortunately for us, we were, because... At the same time, you know, they could have looked at us and gone, oh, it's just the same as all the other ones.
Yeah.
But we kind of, I like to think it's because, you know, we had a little bit more quality in some ways than some of the others.
Yeah.
That's, at least my ego says that. But
and we came out on time, too. We
swore to ourselves we would never be late, because Rich is the businessman of the two of us, Rich Rankin. And he says, you know, the thing, the real retailers, your book is late, they start losing interest in you.
Yeah.
And especially when you're an independent like we were.
Yeah.
So we always went out of our way. And we had a couple of years under our belt already as professionals. we went out of our way to always be on time. We had our projects done way before it would ever be due to come in.
Sure.
When the thing fizzled out, Apple Comics had come along and they took on the project, and we were still meeting our deadlines and they started missing theirs.
Yeah.
And that is what ultimately killed the book, I think, is because we would do the book, get it in ahead of time, and they would futz around with it for whatever reasons they had. I can't tell you. And the book would come out late. And then as the book came out later and later and later, then the retailer said, well, I guess we're not going to do that book anymore. And it ended around 23.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. I mean, it's so interesting to me because as much as, you know, as much as you think sort of the business has changed over the years, there's still a lot that stayed the same in a way where it's like, yeah, you got to get your books out on time. But, you know, I know through, you know, reading and stuff like that in history, I think I'm a little bit younger than you guys. But I was reading comics in the 80s and I was only really exposed to indie stuff like a little bit later on, because then I started discovering actual comic book shops, you know, as opposed to the newsstand. But sure. For me, what's always interesting is because obviously now you have the internet and you sort of conventions have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. But how did you guys like sort of like network and come together back then? Did you all guys go to cons? Were you like, how did you get involved with Kimiko sort of in the first place? Because to me, the idea was always like, you know, based off of the Marvel sort of thing, was that there was a bullpen and everyone lived in New York and they all came to the office. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, so how did that work for like indie creators? And then I guess another segment of that question is how did you guys sort of notice that this black and white boom was happening? Because now you have the internet and you have like people like just, you know, like this is big and you're surrounded by PR. But back then it seems like it would be like a network of stores or zines or something. And like, how did you guys notice that that wave was coming? You know, does that make sense? Do those questions make sense?
I think a lot of that had to do with Rich, as I say, because me, I always said, I just want to sit at my table and draw my pictures, you know, tell my stories.
Yeah.
And Rich was the one who was willing to go out and do stuff, you know, actually go out and talk to retailers and distributors and things like that. And in those days, that's what you had to do. You had to really go out and knock on doors, make phone calls, go to the distributor, I guess, conventions or whatever they were called then.
Yeah.
And talk to all these people and show them your product. And ultimately, we convinced them that, you know, they were going to order our product. And I never really got involved in a lot of the business end of it. I just, like I say, I kind of, you know, left that all in Rich's lap. And, but he's the one who basically told me about all this. He also had worked in a comic, when I first met Rich, he was working in a comic shop. Okay. He was the manager of Heroes World at this local mall where I live.
Okay.
And that's how we got to know each other. So he already knew how these things worked.
Interesting.
So he's a kind of, Jack may know a bit more about the business end of it too than I do. So if he has something to chime in on there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing about back in the 80s is that this is before the internet, of course. And it's also before like cell phones.
Yeah.
You know, we're just picking up the phone and calling someone in another part of the country can be an expensive proposition.
Yeah.
The thing is that seemed like everywhere you would go, certainly every major city had its own little clique of comic book developer community.
Okay.
And the conventions were important to kind of bring all those people together. And I think what got me into the industry, part of it was just kind of being friends with Jeff, of course, that I had done Villains Vigilantes with when he went to the Kubert School, met a lot of people. He wound up getting into the comics industry his own way, and I kind of followed along a little bit. But being in Chicago, I wound up going to conventions and falling in with a group of people that were putting out a little indie book called Just Imagine. That were kind of like a little local Chicago-produced comic book. I don't know if it ever really got very far out of the Midwest. But
I'm pretty sure I've seen some of those. Yeah,
I don't think I've ever heard of it, but okay.
You know, it was kind of a nice little launching pad for a bunch of people that later went on to do well in the industry. Mark Nelson, who went on to do the Aliens comics and Dark Horse.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Jill Thompson had her first work published there. Doug Rice, who was an artist at First Comics, Lennon Del Sol, if you know who he is, another guy that did a lot of stuff at First Comics. Uh-huh. And First Comics was another area that another big company in the Chicago area as well. So I think it depended on if you had like a community that you could kind of cling to that was somehow connected to it. And of course, with the indie comics boom, with you know, it's suddenly the thing that broke in the 80s was that you no longer had to be in New York with where Marvel and DC were.
Yeah.
You know, you could wind up being in Pennsylvania, and you might wind up in the orbit of Kimiko. You could be out in Portland, and there the Dark Horse guys were, or out in California where Eclipse and Pacific were. So it was an interesting time, and it was a great place to get a whole new generation of talent from all over the country into the industry. So
it's really interesting to me because I remember being younger and sort of noticing an issue of like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and like picking it up and not like looking at it. It's funny. And it just didn't click with me for some reason. Like the artwork did not click with me. And I know that that was sort of one of the black and white books that kind of like helped cause the explosion, right? Because it became sort of like super popular. And then recently, just out of curiosity, I picked up like one of the IDW like hardcovers and ordered it in the mail, and it came, and I opened the book, and I was like, I looked at the art, and I'm not trying to insult anybody, but I was like, oh, wow, this is a little bit cruder than what I was expecting it to be, because I kept hearing for years and years and years how this thing exploded, and everyone was just, but then I read it, and I was like, oh, wow, and this is really fun, you know what I mean? Like, and the interesting, I guess just the interesting thing to me is, as a young kid, how much I was really locked into that DC Marvel, you know, this is the way things should be. And to me, it's just so interesting how guys like you and other companies like First and Kimiko were kind of like out there and doing like creative work that I may not have been aware of as a kid.
I think what happened then is one of those times where things got to be so much the same that when something different came along, you noticed it even more. It was like an old, there's an old comic strip I saved many years ago, cut out of the newspaper, which shows some ice flowing around in the Antarctic, and it's covered in penguins. It's a whole bunch of penguins standing on it. Yeah. I think it's a Gary Larson's cartoon, and they're all standing there on the piece of ice, looking off to the left of the frame, and there's one penguin in the middle of it, looking off to the right. And that for me always summed up what I wanted to do in comics right there. I don't want to be the one that's one of 500 other people. I want to be the one that stands out from the crowd.
Sure.
And I think that's what was happening then. These things, you know, everybody was used to the look of the color comics that came out, DC and Marvel specifically.
Yeah.
And suddenly these books came out that weren't even in color, which is, oh my God, that's horrendous.
Yeah.
Not in color. They're not about superheroes. And they feel like they were written by one of your friends.
Yeah.
You know, they were, and which essentially is what it was. They were a bunch of fans making fan-made comics.
Yeah.
And some of them were more talented than others, and some of them, the writers were more talented than others. But I think that was part of it. I think that might be true mainly because of the same thing that happened with Image Comics when they came along.
Yeah.
There were several of those artists whose names shall not be mentioned who weren't necessarily what you'd call great artists.
Yeah.
But they clicked with people because they clicked with the fans, the young people.
Yeah.
Because they said, oh, look at this. Maybe I could even do that someday. When you looked at Kurt Swan's work or Alex Toth's work or Jack Kirby's work, there isn't for a second any of us when we were young said, oh, I could do that. Because it just looks so amazing.
See, that's
but
interesting.
When you looked at, you know, the independent stuff, you said, oh, you know, I could actually do that too.
Yeah. Yeah, but that stuff also served as such an inspiration, like the Jack Kirby stuff, because it's funny because when I was a kid, again, this shows like my limited mindset when I was younger, like I wasn't into Jack Kirby. It was only when I got into my teens and 20s and saw a museum, you know, gallery of like Kirby's original work where I was like, holy cow, this guy was on fire. Like, this is amazing. But for some reason, when I was younger, you know, it didn't click with me. And there was a part of me that felt like maybe because it was very angular or something at the time, like I felt like, oh, I could do that. But obviously I couldn't, you know what I mean?
So I think it has to do with a certain progress of everybody as they get older. I think music has a certain connection too. When we listen to music when we're younger, it tends to be a certain kind of music. Like say, let's just say, for example, rock, because it's very simple and you understand it.
Sure.
You can get into it. And then as you get older, suddenly you hear something called jazz and you go, wait a minute, that sounds, but as a kid, you would never have listened to it.
Exactly.
I think it's the same with the art. I think when I look back at some of my favorite artists, of course, when I was a kid, which was in the old days, you know, I mean, I was in the comic shop when Spider-Man number one came out. That's how old I am. So
when
I saw people like Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, those guys for some reason connected with me, though I can't, at that time, I could never understand why.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I loved Kurt Swan's work on Superman. And his stuff was very realistic. And then in the 70s, you know, Neil Adams came along and he was always considered a realistic artist, though if you really look at his work, it's not realism.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, I think what happened is that what happens is as you get older, you start to appreciate certain things you never appreciated when you were younger.
For sure.
You see them with different eyes, of course, because you're older.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, your worldview opens up for sure. Yeah. And you're exposed to like a lot more things. Like as I got older, you're exposed to like fine art. You go to museums and stuff like that. And you're like, oh, wait a minute. Like I very specifically remember a trip to a museum when I was a teenager and seeing art that I probably wouldn't have paid attention to and just being like, oh, this is better than the stuff that I'm trying to, not better, but different or, you know, more advanced. I don't know, but the stuff that I was absorbed with in the comics, you know, and I was like, what does that mean to me? And, you know, it gets you seeking out other stuff. That's really interesting. So, yeah, I guess it's funny because, like I said, I did not read Eagle. I did not read Elementals when I was a kid. I was probably like preteens or teens when it came out. And, you know, it just wasn't on the newsstands, right? So I didn't have a way to find it.
Not as much as DC or Marvel.
Yeah, absolutely. But then later on, you know, I would come to try and discover this stuff and try and hunt it down. So with the Eagle project, is this like a sequel or is it, are you revamping it or
it was really, I have to say, and I don't know if it, he really wants me to mention this, but James Kuhurek, who is one of the fellows that works at American Mythology, the company that's putting this out,
okay,
is an old friend who became a friend because he was a fan. He was actually a fan of Eagle in the 80s.
Oh, okay.
He was, I think he's probably a little, I'm not sure, but he might be a little older than you, but he grew up reading comics in the 80s.
Yeah.
And he was a fan of that. And my other comic I did at the time, Fright Night.
Oh,
and
okay.
I had met him at a convention years ago where he said, oh, I was a fan of Fright Night and blah, 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 and told me about that and about Eagle. And for years, he's been very, very supportive of me. And it was about 4 years ago, he helped me put together a reprint of Eagle of the first six issues.
Oh, wow.
That came out through Moonstone, but it only sold like about 200 copies or 250 copies, something like that. But he's always been pushing to try to get this together. When he got involved with American Mythology, excuse me, he said, are you interested to try doing Eagle again? I said, well, of course I am. And so he's really the one that instigated getting that started again. But this particular project is going to be, at least for now, a one-shot.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be, half of the book is going to be the very first issue of Eagle that came out back in 86. But I added an ink wash to it.
Okay.
So it's to give it a little bit different look than it had originally. And hopefully bring the artwork up a few levels from where it was. and the other half of the book is a brand new story that Jack and I have written and drawn. And it's essentially, you could call it a sequel. It's kind of hard to call it an exact sequel because the book, the series itself didn't really end.
Uh-huh.
No, there was no end storyline.
Sure.
We got cut off in the middle of a story. A couple years later, Rich had started a comic book company, a small comic book company. We put out a mini series that kind of wrapped up the one story, and that's where it ended, sometimes in the early 90s.
Uh-huh.
And so this is this story presumes that the end story we were always working towards in the series, which was this one particular villain of Eagles, that they had finally clashed. And this is the story of what happened after they clashed. And then there's supposed to be like a 20-year gap of when that happened and when this story picks up.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a reintroduction to Eagle in a way. The people who are fans of the book, I think, will catch on very quickly. New people to the book, I'm not too sure, because some of, we never really liked explaining everything. We think that's boring.
Yeah.
Like people to kind of pick things up as they go along, and like we did with the original series. So it's a little bit of both. It's got the old and it's got the new. We're doing the same with the companion book, Death's Dark Angel, which was a spin-off character from the series. And he's kind of a supernatural Terminator, I guess would be the way to put it.
Yeah, talk more about him, because that design is really cool. That is a pretty badass character design.
He was a character that I created, one of the many characters I created before I ever got in the comic business. And I had drawn a character. He was just this big lumbering character. It was in 82, I think it was, around 1981, 82, which was a few years before I started in the business. And I drew this big lumbering character with this kind of black outfit, and he had these two sawed-off shotguns, and he had just a half a skull face, like he didn't have the jaw or anything.
Yeah.
And it was just an image I came up with, and I called him Death's Head for the obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And I had that, of course, by the time we did Eagle, which was a good 4 or 5 years later, I said, I'd love to bring this character into the storyline somehow. We came up with an idea, we worked it out, and then from there, Jack helped expand on the concept of the character. And we did one issue of the series, the first issue of Death's Head, the first and only issue. And after it came out, we got a letter from Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
That said that they have a book called Death's Head, which we found out was a British thing. I think it was Robots or something. I forget now.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of know this.
And,
yeah.
And because it was, even though it was a British created book, you know, they say they had the rights to the name,
yeah,
but you can't use that title.
Okay.
So we just never did a second issue.
Oh, okay.
And, but the character itself showed up a couple more times within the Eagle series. So what we decided to do is we wanted to do the Death's Head, Death's Dark Angel is what we call him now, because that was the title of one of his stories.
Uh-huh.
And of course, again, we can't use Death's Head, far as I know.
Sure.
So that, we're doing a one shot of that also. That's going to be coming out the following month. And it's, again, the same thing. It's the one issue that came out, which I'm adding ink wash to, and a brand new story, which actually was originally started in the Eagle series, the last few issues. There was a backup we did that continued the Death's Head story. And so this is the both books are one shots that we're hoping will go beyond that, you know, with Eagle and Death's Dark Angel.
Oh, that's great. And is Death's Dark Angel like an anti-hero, sort of like a Punisher kind of character?
Well,
is he a villain?
He's a little of everything. He's a little of all of that, actually. He's
a force of nature.
He's actually tied to Eagle. I don't know if I should tell you how. I mean, it's been exposed in the previous story when it came out, but you've never read any of those stories.
Uh-huh.
But he is literally, in one sense of the word, connected to Eagle's character itself.
Okay.
And maybe I'll let you read it yourself to see what I mean. I don't want to give it all away.
Okay.
There are some people who haven't read the stories yet.
Sure, sure.
But there is a connection. There is literally an actual connection between the two characters.
Oh, that's great.
Except Death's Head's character, Death's Dark Angel's character, takes place in a far future.
Oh, really?
Many more years. I don't even remember how many years we put him ahead, but Jack came up with this wonderful expansion of the whole concept of the future story.
Uh-huh.
If you've ever read any of the Judge Dredd stories, you know how they establish that the city is like one humongous city.
Yeah.
You know, all over. I think it's called Megalopolis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We kind of follow along that same basic idea, which is it's just, you know, it's like New York all over the entire East Coast or something like that.
Oh, basically. Gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
And it's not today's New York. It's the It's the Charles Bronson movie, The Warriors kind of New York.
Oh, that's great.
It's the exploitation movie New York.
Wow.
Yes. And Death's Dark Angel, basically, he is a kind of a force of nature. He's let's say he's as much a force of justice as Eagle was, except without a lot of the moral borders.
Gotcha.
And for the same token, he's not just some mass killer. He doesn't just, you know, like the Punisher or something, killing gangsters.
Sure.
it's kind of hard to describe him without giving away everything about him. In other words, it's
a, oh, no,
you'll see when you read the story.
But I mean, you've got me hooked in just with like, hey, this is like New York Warriors, like 70s Charles Bronson. Like, yeah, I mean, that's stuff that.
But with more, but with much more of a sci-fi angle, you know, flying cars and so there's the old city, which would be considered, say, Eagles City.
Yeah.
Is now below the new city. That's how far in the future it is. It's like the old city is you know, old and decaying. It's like the slums, and the corporate city above, you know, with all the rich people and everything is above that. And Death's Head sort of comes, Death Star Archangel sort of comes from that city below and moves up to the top city for reasons you'll see in the story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just, it sounds like right up my alley. I mean, it sounds like totally bonkers in a good way. You know what I mean? Like, it just sounds like something that it's just really interesting that I'm so surprised that I never came across Eagle, because I, every once in a while, I would hunt down like stuff that was independent and, you know, I guess it just never came across my radar, especially with being a fan of both of you guys. And I had just seen you guys posting on Facebook and I was like, what is this Eagle thing? And then that you started a Kickstarter. So I'm just like really happy that you guys are doing it. Why jump to Kickstarter though? And not like, have you guys thought about, you never thought about like just putting it on the web or anything like that? Like as a comic?
We had considered that a couple of times through the last few years. We talked about that a little bit.
Yeah.
The Kickstarter thing is not really our idea.
Oh, okay.
That was James Kahorek's idea.
Okay.
At American Mythology. He had definitely planned on putting the book out one way or the other through his company, because he was determined to create what he calls the Vokesverse within the concept of the company somewhere, where all these stories that are being created by, actually I'm even doing three other series at some point in this.
Oh, wow.
But he said mainly because of printing costs, he thought it would be a good idea to start a Kickstarter to help, you know, cover some of the printing costs, because it goes without saying it's unlikely Eagle's going to get huge numbers. It's just not that well known, even by fellows your age who grew up during that time. Don't even really know it.
Yeah.
And so trying to, again, sell a black and white, he was even willing to do the book in black and white. Trying to sell a black and white book of something that came out 30 years ago is taking a bit of a risk. So he thought, let's do a Kickstarter. You know, you have Eagle fans out there. Let's see what happens. And that maybe that little extra money would help augment some printing costs. That way, at least we get the book out.
Sure. Sure.
So it was really him who suggested that I am doing it through their company. This is not, you know, it's not like we're independently making this book.
Gotcha.
So now if, God forbid, the book doesn't do well enough to go to a series, I have a feeling that Jack and I are going to try to do something with it afterwards anyway.
Yeah.
Just because we got our, you know, blood boiling again about it and people seeing it again. So unless Jack disagrees with me on that.
Oh, no, I definitely agree. One thing I just need to also mention too, because Neil is probably just too humble to talk about it, is that the ink wash he's put on this artwork really, really gives it a great kick. I mean, when you're looking at artwork someone did from, you know, previous decades, no one is completely happy looking at their work from that time. But not only does the work he did from then really hold up with the ink wash on it, it really gives it a very slick, modern look that really kind of it's going to excite a lot of people. Even people who have seen and known the original are going to be surprised it's just artistically almost like getting a whole new book here. I also want to say that I like your comment you made before about totally bonkers in a good way. if we could put that in quotes, maybe use that in an ad or something. We need to stir that comment to James. So I mean, hopefully, you know. The idea of you know, some little book that got attention back in the day, trying to make a comeback. I don't know. You know, it's kind of like I don't know. What did they say about the Velvet Underground? They put out an album that only sold 10,000 copies, but everyone that bought one went out and formed their own band.
Yeah.
You know?
hopefully, you know, when we talk about creators that kind of inspire the fan base and all that sort of stuff, hopefully we can generate that kind of interest. And
well, I think that's actually what happened, Jack. That's a great analogy, because through the years since Eagle, you know, ended, which, like I say, was at the very early 90s, I've met and become friends with a few of them, like James, who I mentioned, who were Eagle fans in the 80s as young people, and through those years became comic book professionals, uh-huh. artists, like, I don't know if you know Troy Nixie's name. He worked at, I think it was IDW and such, and a few others, and he then went on to actually direct a feature film produced by Guillermo del Toro, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. He was an Eagle fan. James Gorick was the Eagle fan. All these people that I've met grew up reading that book and became professionals.
That's great.
So that did kind of happen. We planted the seed, as it were, the same way I got started, the same way I'm sure Jack got started. We read books as a kid that inspired us to want to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And I've been told that many, many times. I mean, it's hard to keep my humility sometimes, because these people come along and tell me, oh, you don't know how much Eagle meant to me. I met this young fella at a convention a couple of years ago. He comes over. He's this big, strapping guy. I mean, he must have been in his early 30s or something, big, huge fella. And he comes over and says, oh, I am so – and he was just gushing all over me about how he grew up reading this book. It's his favorite book. It's his favorite artist and all this. And I'm just like sitting there, you know, blushing. Because you never really, I don't think you really think about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That you're doing the same thing for some people that other artists or writers did for you when you were growing up, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like when I first met Jack Kirby or something like that, it was like, oh my God, I'm meeting God himself, you know?
Sure.
And of course, he never thinks of himself that way.
But yeah.
That, as far as I know, anyway. It's really gratifying to know that not only was I entertaining myself while I worked on this book, but I was entertaining a bunch of people that went on to start entertaining other people with their work.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fascinating how that sort of thing happens.
Well, it definitely blows my mind, and especially you two guys, you know, having you on, and the people that I have had on the podcast, you know, that, you know, I meet them or at a convention or something and I'm like gushing, and I definitely feel like an idiot because like, I'm like, I live in LA. I don't like get starstruck unless it's something from like my childhood or my teenage years. You know what I mean? Like my big joke is like, if I ever met Lee Majors, I would probably pass out like right in front of him. You know what I mean? Like that's like how much of an and you know, these days, like you would say to like my 9-year-old daughter, like Lee Majors, and she'd be like, who's that? You know what I mean? Like, so, but to me, you know, there are definite things, and it just always astounds me how much, particularly comic book, many comic book professionals, I mean, you have your exceptions whose, you know, names I won't mention, who think they're, you know, pie in the sky and God's gift, but how much comic book creators kind of like, it's not put themselves down, but don't see themselves as don't see what they've inspired in like other people. You know what I mean? And some of them even try and discount it. Like, no. And it's like, no, you don't understand. Like the stuff that you put out in the world, it made a difference. You know what I mean? And, you know, even though I didn't know what Eagle was, I mean, obviously Jack, you know, with Villains and Vigilantes, I mean, I'm starting to think about putting another group together, you know, and then Neil with those Superman stories. I remember reading those, and I've always been like a huge Superman fan, mostly because of the Christopher Reeve, you know, movie probably made an impact on me when I was like 5 years old. Sure. But I remember reading those Superman adventures and being like, why can't the regular comics be like this? You know what I mean? Because I don't think that I've always thought that there was some sort of big corporate interference, you know what I'm saying, with how Superman should be. But those Superman Adventures books were like the purest, you know what I'm saying, like distillation of the character to me.
Well, we talked about this when we did the Flesh and Blood interview.
Yeah.
How with Superman, the thing that I think that made Superman Adventures so much fun, well, that's the answer right there, because it was fun.
Yeah.
It was like the original comics I read as a kid in the late 50s into the 60s, where all these individual stories, I mean, it wasn't all about continuity and everything. You know, every issue you'd get a different story, which didn't necessarily connect to any other stories. and they were just individual enjoyable stories.
Yeah.
And as the world changed, comics changed too. The tone of the comics changed. They got darker. They, you know, they got a little more realistic in one sense of the word.
Yeah.
And had to deal with certain things, like when the drug thing came into like Green Lantern and Green Arrow,
yeah,
back in the 70s, things started to change. You couldn't do the same kind of stories because the world wasn't quite as, or at least the young people weren't quite as innocent,
sure,
as they were before the, you know, late 60s with all the stuff that happened with Vietnam and everything.
Yeah.
And because tones changed, comics changed. And I think the thing that made Superman Adventures and the Batman Adventures book also so much fun was because that's all they were. They were just fun, enjoyable stories. They weren't about, you know, the world going to hell in a handbasket. And they weren't about all the issues that the character has and all that stuff. It was just fun to open a comic, relax, read it, and enjoy it, and instead of feel depressed at the end of it or something.
So, yeah,
like so, yeah, many comics nowadays seem to be very depressing from what I can see.
Yeah. Obviously there are changes that characters have to go through for sure, or companies have to go through to keep their readership up. But I definitely, you know, I mean, if we're talking about that specific book, I think that you can do stuff that maintains the spirit and tone and still be entertaining to an adult like me, who, like,
yeah,
I've gone back and reread some of those and I'm just like, this is, yeah, I love this, you know?
Well, they were some of my favorite stories to ever work on. I mean, I think I told you that last time too, about the ones with Mr. Miracle was in it, and I loved doing that one. And
yeah,
and the one with the crypto, with the puppy.
Yeah.
Which I Templeton wrote, which is a wonderful story.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in any case, I feel badly now that I missed out on Eagle. And there's,
well, you're going to have to make up for it now.
I'm going to have to track these issues. Is there any way to track the older issues down? I mean, other than eBay?
I mean, I myself have had to order copies of my own books through the mail just because I don't have extra copies.
Wow.
And it's comparatively easy to track them down. In fact, I've seen on eBay people that sell the entire run.
But, oh, okay.
I can't for a fact tell you how much that would have been or anything, but
yeah. Well, have you guys ever thought of trying to get in on Comixology or something? I mean,
It's going to be.
Oh, is it really?
Yes. American Mythology. James has instigated us digitizing all the old issues.
Oh, great.
And they're going to be put up on Comixology in the months to come.
Oh, wow.
You'll get the whole series anyway.
Yeah. Oh, I'm definitely going to have to check that out when it comes out. So, wow, that's great. I mean, I'm excited. I mean, I've contributed to the Kickstarter, and I hope other people out there listening will too. I mean, I know you guys have made your goal, but I mean, more money is good. So,
more money is always good.
We want to keep it. So, just to quickly go back, I know I've had you guys on for close to an hour, and Neil has the flu. But the one thing I want to ask Neil is, did you just let it slip that you might be, you said you had several other ideas or comics that you might be working on? Like, are we working on a line of your own comics, Neil? Or
I wouldn't call it that. But like I said, I jokingly called it the Vokesverse because that's what Jim called it once. But I wouldn't say I let it slip so much as I mentioned it because I wanted to. But when Jim and I talked about all the stuff that we could do with Eagle and then Death's Head, Death's Dark Angel, I have to keep reminding myself.
Death's Dark Angel.
He said, do you have any other ideas? Because he originally talked to Bob Tunnell and I about maybe doing Flesh and Blood through American Mythology. Bob is so busy with his film work, which explains a little bit why there's no Flesh and Blood number 4 yet.
Yeah.
And so he thought it'd be nice to do like a kind of shared universe thing of horror and stuff like that. And we're still discussing that on and off. But as far as I was concerned, I said, well, let's do Eagle. Let's do the next thing. But I have all these other ideas. I mean, Jack and I alone could start a whole company. Just
sure.
We couldn't literally physically do them all ourselves, but we could certainly easily come up with an entire line of books just on all the stuff we've talked about through the years. So one of the new projects beyond the Eagle stuff is going to be called Walpurgis Night, which ties right in with Jack's profile picture there.
Okay.
The Lucador. We did a short story and the Monsterverse for the Tales from the Grave comic.
Okay.
Purgus Night, which introduces this Mexican wrestler who fights monsters.
I remember that. Okay.
Yeah, and he's kind of based on the Blue Demon and Else and Santo, the old Mexican monster fighting wrestlers.
Yeah.
But he's got a twist to him, and that odds are, if we get the chance, we're going to do that one too.
Oh, that's great.
I'm also doing a project with a writer named James R. Tuck. He writes some horror novels and such. And I had met him at a horror convention a couple years ago. We talked about doing something. We did a story for the Monsterverse also, a short story. And we came up with a project we're going to do called Shadows Over Whitechapel, which is kind of a I guess you could call it an alternate universe version of the Jack the Ripper story, which has a kind of Gotham by Gaslight feel, you know, the Batman that Mike Mignola did, Gotham by Gaslight.
Yeah,
the kind of Victorian era Batman. There is a character similar to that in there, but there's also this Jack the Ripper-based character that's been committing these murders in Whitechapel. But we find out there's a connection to Lovecraftian creatures.
Oh, wow.
So that's why it's called Shadows Over Whitechapel. There's that one I'm going to be doing pretty soon, too, in the next few months, probably. And there's one with an old friend of mine, David Zuzello, who also has never written comics before, but certainly... loves them with a passion. In fact, all I do is hear about Deadpool from him. and he also, and I have been friends for many years in the within the horror realm, and he has this project he and I came up with based on the old Sword and Sandal movies, you know, the old Hercules movies and stuff, Italian films. And it's called Machiste, which was the actual original Italian myth that all those other characters came from. But it's more of the way we've been talking about. The pitch is basically... it's an R-rated Thundar the Barbarian.
That sounds, I mean, I'm in. So. Like, that, you need to make, that's all you had to say to me. Like, I was like, yeah, I'm in. That's great. But did I hear you, did I see you post something about Parliament of Justice? Were you going back to that?
Mike Oeming and I, of course, when we did that, which is where my whole love of doing the Inkwash thing came from, working on that project, We talked through the years with about maybe doing another one. A lot of people will come up to us and have us sign the book and then say, when's number two coming out?
Yeah.
That was because Image apparently put a number one on the cover. Well, there was never meant to be any more stories.
Okay.
It was a self-contained story. It had a beginning, middle, and an end, which is apparent if you've read the book.
Yeah.
And we always joked and said, oh, yeah, and in the next one, the character gets up off the sidewalk and he's still alive.
Yeah.
But... Mike and I have talked about it, doing some more in that universe that we created, and not about that character, but about, you know, related characters.
Sure.
And he's talked about it, and I've talked about it, but he's, as you know, he's really busy doing all the stuff he's doing. And now I've gotten busy again. I asked him about it recently. I said, you know, I'd love to get back to that. Mike threatens us doing it, but I don't know if it's going to happen. I can't really say.
Okay.
So if he comes up with a story someday, yeah, I think we'll probably do it. But
well, that's great. Well, that sounds great. Sounds like you're busy. Jack, how's the Villains of Vigilantes thing going?
You know, things are happening and things have happened. I'm not at liberty to say anything yet, but there will be an announcement soon.
Oh, I hope it's a good announcement because I'm a big fan. No, that's great. Well, thank you guys for coming on. You know, I appreciate you taking the time and, you know, I wish you all the luck with the Eagle Project and anything else that you guys, you know, are working on. Obviously, you're keeping busy. Neil, I love seeing your artwork on your Facebook page, like your Batman stuff just blows me away. My only comment would be I want more Superman stuff, but that's just me. That's just me.
That's the funny thing. The Superman stuff I did reluctantly.
Really?
Not because I didn't like Superman, because the first comic I ever read was a Superman comic.
Oh, okay.
But it was because I wanted to do the Batman comic so bad.
Oh, okay.
And which is why you always see all these drawings of Batman all the time.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do the Batman Adventures comic. I talked to the editor. He said, well, we'll talk about it. And it never happened. And then an opening came along for the Superman one. And I said, well, all right. And I did it. And then once I got going on it, I actually really enjoyed it because it brought back memories of the days when I was a kid reading Superman.
Yeah, so. Superman gets no respect.
He gets no. Well, it's always going to be. Look at the movies. The same thing. I mean, this whole Superman thing that's happening now, the people really want to see Batman. They don't want Batman's always done great in the movies, it seems, in comparison to anything with Superman. Even though the first Superman with Christopher Reeve did very well, I think Batman is the more loved of the two characters for some. Maybe it's because, again, because of the era we're in, the generation we're in.
I just don't think they've gotten Superman right for a long time. That's why.
Yeah, they had elements of it right in the film and other elements that, well, again, it's kind of hard to say because each of us has our own interest in a certain character. And Superman has been portrayed in many different ways.
Oh, sure.
As well as Batman has.
Yeah.
I think Batman is just more adaptable. I think you could do goofy Batman and dark Batman very easily, totally opposite, but work. But Superman is kind of, it's harder to pull off. And I think the only one that we both agree on that really pulled it off was the Christopher Reeve one, the very first one.
Yeah. I mean, as far as film is concerned, but yeah,
it had the right tone because I think mainly because of him.
Yeah.
I think it really was the casting made that film work. It was a very well done movie in its way, but I think you had to have a character like him that could stand there with his arms folded, say truth, justice, in the American way, and you didn't laugh at him.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it wasn't goofy. Even in 78, that was still kind of cheesy when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yet he pulled it off. He made you believe this guy believes this.
Well, and that's...
That was the best thing about it.
I mean, we could do a whole hour on Superman alone, but, oh, you know, yes. Like, quite honestly, for me, it is very much that embracing of the character and embracing of the ideals and you know, imbuing him with a personality that makes that first movie work. And every yes. other film, I mean, the second one is fun is in its own way, but it gets a little crazy too. Yes. But
goofy, yeah.
But so there have been goofy elements of Superman, you know, for years and years. Just look at the Golden Age, you know. But my thing is that there hasn't been, up until this Supergirl show, a character that has imbued that sort of the essence of the you know, comic book or what it's kind of meant to stand for in a way, or what it came to stand for, like in the past, like whatever 30, 40,
yeah,
50 years.
I agree. I think this girl show has pulled that off nicely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you can do that in a film. And part of my biggest problem, a lot of people are like with me whenever we get into an argument and we're totally going off on a tangent, but my whole thing is that, you know, Man of Steel, you didn't get to know Superman. You didn't get to know Clark, despite the father dying in the tornado, despite the Zod death or anything like that. For me, it was like, what is this guy about? Like, there's nothing here for me to latch on to. It's just fight, fight, fight. You know, I'm sad, 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 fight, fight, fight. But what, like, there's no charm to it. So Superman should have a charm to him, you know, and he just didn't have that. And it's funny because I was talking with friends last night at dinner, and one of my things was, you know, one of the big things between Batman and Superman is like, who do you want to have over for dinner? You want to have the brooding, you know, one percenter who's like so upset, but he lives in a mansion and, you know, he's not nice to people and he snaps at you if you don't do exactly what he wants. Or do you want to have the guy who's going to help you with the dishes, open the door for the ladies, you know, help you put the coleslaw together? You want that guy. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, I agree.
So that's just me. And
I think with Zack Snyder, his style is more suited to Batman than Superman.
Sure.
I think that was part of it. He pulled it off. I mean, he made a big film. It worked. I mean, for a lot of people, obviously, because it made money. But and I like parts of it.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. It's not. Well, I would say it's not my Superman.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not also so awful as some people make it either. It's just that it's just not my Superman. But however, it looks like he has my Batman, though.
Yeah, well, you know, here we go.
It's a trailer. It's a trailer, so you can't really tell until you see the movie.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is I don't need to see a movie where, like, a Superman that I didn't like in the first place. It seems like the main event for that movie is to see Superman get his ass kicked. And I'm like, I don't need to see
that. I think that was always their intention, is that the incidents that occurred in the first story are dealt with in the second story.
Yeah, well, and I just don't need to see it. That's just me. And we've totally veered off. Everyone should go to Kickstarter and look up Neil Vokes's name and contribute to the Eagle Kickstarter, because that's what we should be focusing on. And not a Superman nerd fight. But but thank you guys for coming on. It's always great talking to you guys.
Yeah, well, let's try not to wait another 4 years before we do this.
No, absolutely. I mean, whenever you've got something new, just hit me through Facebook.
Well, I just told you, I've got three or four more projects coming up, so we'll have plenty to talk about.
Absolutely. You're welcome to come on. I'm a big fan. And, you know, for people who've been listening, we said it before, I've got Jack Herman and Neil Vokes, and go to Kickstarter and check out the Eagle Kickstarter project. They've already funded it, but more money is better. So just keep throwing money at it and stretch goals. And my name is Christian Horn, and this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. And I hope Neil gets better from having the flu. And we'll be back with another episode soon. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
Part-Time Fanboy.